This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Instructed to get going.
We're going.
So this is the Making Games for Good panel. If that sounds unfamiliar, you might be in the wrong room. Introductions seem like a great place to start. My name is Liz Liddell. I am an editor at Paizo, and I kind of dig this stuff. I find it really fascinating, so that's why I'm here.
I'm Lisi Pelizar. I'm also an editor at Paizo, and I also find it fascinating.
I'm Crystal Frazier. I'm a developer at Paizo, and I guess I find it fascinating, too.
Fascinating.
So this panel kind of came about because we have, for many years at Paizo, and I think we've seen it in the broader gaming community, a concerted push to be better about including women and other gender identities in gaming products, including people of different sexualities in gaming products, and improving the racial diversity in gaming products. And I'm not going to pretend that we have fixed that and that that's done and we can just move on. But because we've sort of made progress in those areas, it's given us sort of some eyes of sensitivity to sort of start looking at some of the other things we've been doing and really ask ourselves, is this the best way we can be doing this? And maybe, are there ways we can do it better? So for some examples, just off the cuff of things we've noticed, a product I was working on at one point, I'm going to try very hard during this panel to not call people out. I don't think that's fair. What I will say is that I'm going to be really open about things that I'm not good at and things I have screwed up, because I think maybe one of the first things to get out of the way is that we are all still learning this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And whoo boy, do we mess it up some. So it's a learning experience, and we're all learning, and that's something we kind of have to be okay with. But a couple of things we've noticed, things like a description of a character as you're going through this adventure, who's repeatedly referred to as crackpot and deranged, and I'm sort of thinking like, what is this message that we're sending here? We've got this person that we're presenting as being non-normative, as having some non-neurotypical behaviors, and pairing that with evil, with bad. That's bad. And do we really want to be setting that expectation that any non-neurotypical behavior is inherently bad, undesirable, and evil? Well, like, no. And, you know, things like when you have villains, you've got these villains who are either described as morbidly obese or skeletally emaciated. And do we really want to be sending the idea that the only way to be good is also to be, like, imperfect physical, like, you know, classical figure? And no, that's not. So that's sort of the things that got me started thinking about some of these questions and how we're doing it. My hope with this panel is that we can just sort of talk about some of the things we've been seeing, some of the ways we've been working to address them, maybe some areas where we want to keep improving, and just sort of, you know, kind of just talk about it. So like a panel, we're going to talk.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's what we do.
So, you know, maybe throw out some other examples of things that we've seen or that we've been trying to address or would like to address.
Okay, sometimes we can actually be a little racist, like very stereotypical stereotype things that we find in our text, and we are trying to improve that as well. Like, I guess educate ourselves more about what we shouldn't be saying about things and what is like a little too stereotypical.
Like, not every Asian person we put in a book has to be a samurai or a ninja. For example.
Yeah.
How many people in this room were in yesterday's diversity panel?
Hi.
Third to half. Okay. I wasn't in yesterday's diversity panel. I was running a game at the time. These are good. I will be really upfront. Race is an area that I'm really weak. That is a blind spot for me, and I know it. And so one of the things that I try to do, and I have the we as the team here have a the advantage that we have each other. And I can say, I don't know how I feel about this. This is throwing a flag for me. What do you guys think? Am I onto something? Am I totally missing? Am I off base? Like, what's going on here? And we can kick those things back and forth. And sometimes, you know, sometimes they just, the reality of publication, they slip past us and we learn and we try to do better next time.
Exactly. We also find a lot of times that we accidentally code, like, female villains, basically. I don't know how to explain it.
As sensual or duplicitous.
Exactly. And, like,
we could just have a female villain who's, like, an anti-paladin in big blocky armor who just murders people.
Yeah.
Right. She has to also hit on the bad guy. Exactly. Hit on the heroes.
Or trick people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, sure, yeah. That's one, actually, I may not have thought to look for.
Manipulative women, basically. Yeah. Or they're punished more in our stories for their sex crimes, like cheating. They'll be punished, be cursed or something, and then men can just, cheat.
As long as with no ill effects.
Or, we have... for whatever reason, the only people worthy of redemption in our books tend to be attractive females.
Exactly.
Like, you'll see a lot of plots about redeeming succubi. Nothing about redeeming a Glabrezu or a Lemure.
Exactly.
One of the not sexy, not female-coded outsiders.
Yeah.
One of the things I did recently was I was working on an adventure, and as I'm going through it, I'm sort of like, oh, this feels really... So when we edit, I don't know if the developers do this, on the editorial team, when we do an edit pass, we track gender as we're going, and then we compare at the end. And I was going through an adventure, I'm like, this feels super, super unbalanced to me. Like, it's throwing up flags. I feel like I'm seeing dudes all the time. I'm not really seeing women. And I sat down and I counted it out, and there were actually more women in that adventure than men. And I'm like, well, what the hell? How am I why am I getting this flag? What's going on? And so I broke down my tried the whole page of them. I broke down this adventure of whether they were named or not named, whether they were alive or dead, whether they were persistent heroes or non-persistent heroes. You know, did they show up in multiple adventures or did they just show up at once? And then just really, really dug into it. And I found things like, we had sort of two people who were roughly of equal social standing. The male of the pair was firmly established in Galarian canon, had a title, first name and last name, had people reporting to him. He had three people reporting to him, two women and one man. One man. I'm an editor, really.
You word good.
Should have heard me last night. The other one, the woman, had a first name. She did have a title, but her title was Lady, whereas the man's title was Doctor. So his title was earned and merit-based. Hers was hereditary and just happened to have it. She didn't have a last name. She had one report, and her report was another female. And I'm thinking, like, these are super subtle things, but basically we've said this man has earned his title, he is more important, he has more, you know, he's important enough to have two names, and shows up in multiple parts of this adventure where this woman is in once and gone. And so some of the changes we made were we changed her report to be a male, so that we, you know, hey, maybe we can have women supervising men. Whoa! Shocker! are there ways that we can hook her back in later in the adventure, even if it's just a mention or two? Because what ends up happening is, I dug into this more, I was like, how did this happen? What's going on? The male character was established as a name in like a player campaign in a campaign setting book a long time ago, sort of like, oh, this is the foremost expert on blah blah blah. And then he got picked up again in a later adventure. You go visit the foremost expert on blah blah blah. And then he's coming back up in this one again. So now he's firmly established as the foremost expert on this stuff. And because we have this one character who's been picked up over and over again, because we just happen to have this bias of having slightly more men than women in the setting, all of a sudden the men we do have in the setting have these rich, recurring backstories, and all of our women are seen once and gone. And so... you know, and so that sort of thing, that project raised a lot of awareness for me about, you know, really, really subtle little things that happen that that we don't think about, even when we're doing numerically the right thing, you know, of things that we can still be doing better, that we can, you know, that we can question ourselves and look at that.
Yeah. One of the things I think you pointed out to me is, and this is something I was doing up until somebody pointed it out, when we have male characters versus female characters, male characters tend to be referred to by their family names more, and female characters tend to be referred to by their given names more, more informally.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's one that happens in academia, too.
And so, quick comment, isn't that kind of actually almost contrary, since most, so if you refer to females by their family name, that's generally a patriarchal structure, right? So, in a way, you're kind of almost, like, lowering that.
It's formal versus informal.
Yeah, that too.
Well, I mean,
yeah, it becomes
That's what I mean, it depends on.
All right, we're going to save questions and comments for the end.
Although, a really interesting thing with that, the decision that we hold to now is we just call everybody by the first name.
Exactly. If either everyone is casual or everyone... Just kind of balance it out. Like, everyone can be on a casual basis, first name basis, or everyone is on a last name basis, basically. Like, as long as it's even.
Yeah. So, what are some other things that we've been... I have a playtest example that I would love to talk about.
Go for it.
So, as you know, you might have heard that we're coming out with Pathfinder 2.
What?
Surprise!
And so that's given us an opportunity to really go back and look at how we are codifying some of these elements in the rules that, up until now, because Pathfinder was built on the 3.5 D&D baggage, that we sort of carried some things over because they were there. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really have a chance to take them apart and rebuild them. Yeah, and now, 10 years later, we've learned some stuff. And we do have that opportunity to really look at how we're doing things. And one of the things that came up was the madness domain.
Yeah.
So we have Lamashtu, mother of monsters, and one of her domains is madness. And the spells that the madness domain gives you are, chaotic evil demon?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the spells that she gives you through that domain are terrible. And we kind of looked at those and said, who else has the madness domain? Can you name a non-evil deity who has the madness domain? There's one.
It's not from the core pantheon.
No. Tsukiyo. Tsukiyo?
Oh, Tsukiyo? Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, the moon god from Tianxia has the madness domain, like Catherine.
Yeah. And so what kind of message is that sending? I'm like, if you have a mental illness, that you're evil? Cool. How about we not do that? And so...
Oh, God, I'm evil.
Yeah, I know, like all of us. We're terrible people. And so...
Yeah, but I'm not terrible because of my mental illness.
Exactly.
So literal. I'm terrible for a bunch of other reasons.
So we have a lot of conversation about how do we do this while recognizing that there are some very powerful and compelling story elements of the idea of having your autonomy taken away from you, of losing control of either your sense of self or identity. And so how do we tie into those storytelling components and maintain those in the stories we want to be able to tell without accidentally disparaging everyone who struggles and fights with anxiety or depression or bipolar disorder or you know, so many other mental illnesses that I couldn't name any of them. How do we do that? And what we've been doing and what we ultimately settled on was to rename the domain Nightmare. Because we felt that captures that same kind of horror from the unknown, that same kind of you aren't in control, because, I mean, who does control their dreams, while decoupling it from this idea of mental illness. Mm-hmm. So we really want to preserve the storytelling components of these. We don't want to take tools out of the storyteller toolbox. We just want to make sure that we're using tools that aren't going to hurt people in the process.
Yeah, we had a similar fight. I'm really glad we got to the point where we'll do this, because we had a similar fight for horror adventures, mm-hmm. where there was a segment within the company that did not want us to have insanity rules. We wanted to rebuild them as stress rules, basically. So instead of like sanity being a resource that's slowly depleted, instead it would be a thing where you can only handle so much stress before you start to come apart at the seams. Just mechanically, it would be almost identical. It's just an issue of how you frame it and how you describe it existing.
Right, right. And then the connotations of those decisions. One of the things that I do that sort of helps me as I'm reading, as editing, we read a lot, it turns out, to help catch some of these things, is I focus on the difference between behavior and identity. And if I'm seeing language that is describing someone, if I'm seeing language that's describing someone instead of their behavior, that's often a flag for me, and I look closer. If they are describing someone as crazy or deranged or what are some of these other words? We've got a whole list of words to watch out for.
Insane.
Mad, insane.
Mad, yeah.
Crackpot, you said earlier. Schizophrenic, throwing that out there
psychopath. Psychopath. Her deranged little brother, that's a flag. Because we're talking, the brother is deranged? Is that what we really want to be talking about? No, what are the behaviors that are happening that are alarming? Because the person themselves shouldn't necessarily be inherently alarming. Unless you're getting into, like, weird monsters, and that's sort of a little bit of a different field. Mm-hmm. But what is that person doing? And here's the thing I found really interesting with this is once we push back and we're like, okay, what are they doing? What can we actually describe here in terms of behavior that's making them evoke this reaction that we want to have in the story? Suddenly you start to get way better descriptions of some like really edgy or creepy or evocative stuff that then lets you focus on the behaviors and not the identity. And so the sort of identity versus behavior rule is something that we sort of use as a tool to sort of make sure that we're focusing on the right things and not framing our games that are going to portray people in ways that we don't intend.
Something that I would like to work on as a writer and a person and an editor is portraying mental illness and stuff like that in a positive light. Like, people can be good. Like, a schizophrenic person can be a good person, and we can have them be a hero and still have schizophrenia or depression or anxiety or something like that.
Yeah, we had a lot of discussion about the art in Gods of Galarian? Fates of Galarian? The new God book coming out.
The new God book coming out.
Whatever we're
referring to. I think it's Fates of Galarian, you're right.
But, I've already forgot his name.
Skio.
We depict a cleric for each of these god articles, and specifically we wanted to demonstrate for Skio that this is... their cleric is somebody who is dealing with a mental illness and has somehow like learned healthier coping mechanisms through their faith. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of debate back and forth about whether or not to show like self-harm scars in the art that have obviously healed for like, you know, metaphorically or as a metaphor for learning to better adapt your own behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I found that a really fascinating question. Cause again, it's, you know, we as a society tend to really skew away from self-harm. Mm-hmm. We say, oh, we don't want to show that. But it's important show this and to help people realize, that this is a behavior that doesn't define the individual, and that it's part of a more complex person in the world, and really help override some of the stereotypes that our society and culture has.
Exactly. It's important for like people in the real world who have passive self-harm, depression, anxiety to see that they're also represented in our product.
In positive ways.
In positive ways, exactly.
Yeah. Iron Fang Invasion had an NPC with a mental illness who I think eventually ended up joining the party?
Probably a couple.
That's just fair. I'm thinking about the one in the tower, the changeling in the tower.
Oh, she hasn't joined the party, but yes, she's got, got paranoia problems because... well, we don't really have like a specific origin for it, but she's a changeling, and her big fixation was on someday my mother is going to come back and I have to be prepared. Mm-hmm. And yeah, eventually you can find her, and she's, because her mother did come back, it's her worst trigger ever, basically, and she's in a bad way, and you can actually talk her down and get her to help, like, help fight back against the hobgoblin invasion, if you don't just, like, kick in the door and kill everyone who's, like, yelling or aggressive.
These people are gonna have trouble in Starfinder. So, what else have we kind of seen? I'm sort of thinking there's a bunch. What have we said in the description of this? Are there areas that we haven't touched on, or areas that you've thought about that? Yeah.
I still know if you guys talk about, like, I know that there's one thing that you haven't talked about that I feel like kind of touches on the stuff
with
the
Lost
Prince or the
Eldest.
Yeah.
So
I'm wondering
if you
have
anything to say about that one.
I don't know anything about it.
Me neither. So the Eldest are the sort of deity-like entities from the First World, the Realm of the Fae, and the Eldest, and so the Dark Prince is one of the Eldest, and is definitionally sort of an embodiment of depression. A lot of melancholy and a lot of depressed people identify with him and follow him or worship him because of that shared identity. I'm going to think about what we've done with him. Probably the last place he would have showed up is Planar Adventures, or maybe First World Realm of the Fae. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something I have noticed and have sort of kept an eye on. And I guess the most I can say about that is that I didn't say anything that made me that threw up a lot of flags for me to say, hey, we want to back up and look at how we're doing this. But I would, I mean, do you feel that representation has been supportive and helpful, or have you found that's been alienating and off-putting?
I really like that deity, which is, I thought it was a positive representation.
Ooh, good to hear. Nice.
I have a character that worships the deity, but I wanted to know if you had anything to say about, like, maybe, like, making that deity, like, the decisions were better, whatever you thought that it was good, or anything.
Yeah, I think it is good, and I think the depression is not something I generally struggle with, but the impression I've gotten from working with that is that it does give that kind of identity piece, and I'm glad we've had it. I think that's probably one of Sutter's creations.
Yeah, nobody else got to touch the first one.
Yeah, it was very, very Sutter-centric. But I know... I want to be careful what I say, because I don't want to speak on behalf of others. But I know from having worked with James Sutter that he is very aware of these issues and has been very receptive to feedback. And so I would guess he probably did have some intentionality there.
I didn't know anything about him, so.
The picture
not Sutter,
of the Green
the
Mother
DNA.
Was just awful.
Oh, no! Well, write what you know. I'm trying to think of other things we've come across in the office lately that we've been working on. Was anyone involved in the... I heard about this tangentially. I was not involved in this. Mm-hmm. But there was some discussion about Heroes from the Fringe? That's what I'm thinking
of. Oh, trying to downplay the idea of... So the book was pitched as, like, exotic heroes... And
that
we've
word.
Tried very hard to back off from that, so we don't have another Bastards of Galarian.
actually, let me enter. Can you let's walk back that one more because I think we're probably all coming from a lot of different places in this. Mm-hmm. If you're sitting here and you're saying, okay, so what would be the problem with Bastards of Galarian? Like, help us unpack that a little bit.
So it's a player companion from a few years ago. And, I mean, the basic concept of it is fine. It's the mixed heritage player companion book. So, half orcs, half elves, I think changelings got a little spread in there.
Dampiers.
But, you know, the all of our playable ancestries that are come from human stock with something else brought in, and, like, there's a lot of storytelling potential for people with mixed heritages. We didn't play it up very well. We talked like half-orcs were a brand new thing that have popped up in like the last 100 years instead of, you know, being around for the last 9 or 10,000 years like they actually have been. And our blurb on the back to sell the book was bad blood.
It hurt.
Yeah. Physically. That was before we had any people of, you know, mixed racial heritage on the Paizo staff.
Yeah. Very, and so then some of the ideas, as I understand, I think I was like, you know, neck deep in playtest at this point, but as I understand, some of that conceptual material was pulled forward for Heroes of the Fringe, and apparently some of the ideas were along with it. And I remember there were conversations around it, but I was wondering if anybody else has been involved.
I was involved in that one. Hi.
Yeah, so this is one word. So I looked at the pre-development files, the development files, and the editorial files. And can you tell us a little bit about what raised flags for you? Because this is where I'm a blind spot. Like I'm sort of like I don't see the problem here. I've been told there is, and I don't.
All I can say is thank goodness Eleanor and Luis were working on that
book. Avi did more on that than I did, probably. So I'm not invested into it. But I just remember being really they face a lot of trouble, obviously, because they're not really welcome by workers, they're not really welcome by workers, and often are treated badly because of their mixed heritage, which is fine as a fact. But then he went on to say that, like, often this makes them stronger individuals. There was something, like, really cringe and interesting about how, like, they're better, stronger people because we're all huge dicks to them.
Yeah, so message, abuse makes you better? Let's not send that one.
Abuse your children if you want them to grow up strong.
You know,
please don't quote me on that.
Crystal says being live streamed.
Oh, God.
Too late.
That clip's going to get taken out of context.
You might
want to
repeat some of that for the live stream just because.
Oh yeah, so the short version is that we've spoke a lot, and I'm going to paraphrase you, that the text spoke a lot about the mixed parentage resulting in an offspring that was sort of not very well welcomed by either side and often experienced a lot of ill treatment because of that, but then went on to say this often makes them stronger and better people. And so the first part statement is fact was largely acceptable, but that second component is where we started, where our team started to catch flags about it.
Yeah, that's really frustrating because I specifically tried to walk so much of that back in Intersea Races, where we talk about halflings having like self-sustaining or half-orcs having self-sustaining populations at this point, because again, orcs and humans have been interacting for 9,000 years. There might be
a city or two.
Yeah, you can have half-orcs who are the parents of two loving half-orcs.
Right.
But
so one of the other things that this makes me sort of think about is oftentimes when Lacey and I are catching these things, stuff has been written and then developed, and then we're getting it the last pass. Mm-hmm. And then we have to go back up the chain and say, hey, look, here's a problem. And so one of the things I wanted to touch on a little bit is how we talk about these problems and how we've built a culture in Paizo about being able to flag these. Mm-hmm. So these are things we're very passionate about, and we're all very passionate about our work. We do things we love. We have a lot of, we put a lot of investment and a lot of us into our work. And so what happens is when we run these problems back up the flagpole, they can be seen as criticism. They can come off as attacks. Because not only are we saying, hey, you done fucked up your work, we're also saying, also, clearly you didn't notice this, so you're a terrible person for doing these awful things, right? And we're not, that's obviously not the message we're trying to send, but we need to be aware that that's a potential for how that's going to be received. As we're running these problems back up, trying to be really careful about not placing blame on the developer or the writer, and not saying, you know, you've made a mistake here, but very much, I noticed this, and it read to me this way that I think might be problematic. What do we think we can do to fix it? Or here's a way I think we can fix it, which I hope is helpful and not like trying to do your job for you.
No, it is super helpful because, I mean, as developers, we are extremely overworked, and it is so easy to let subtle things slide because, well, it doesn't happen as much anymore because we don't work with those writers, but there are some big things we catch, and then we're like, whew! And then we completely miss all the subtle shit.
Yeah, and that happens. That's a reality of the process. And so another part of that is, as we're building up this culture where we are flagging more of these things, I think we're getting, this is going to come across, I'm going to stick my foot in my mouth here right now. We are, as an organization, learning that this is something we want to be better at. Mm-hmm. And so when we're flagging these things, we don't mean it as criticism, that exactly. we want these to be better products, and this is a way we can do that. And so I think the developers are learning that that's our intent. I haven't really worked with the design team much, so I don't know what they think. Hopefully they're on board. They've been really busy. And I think I know that the responses I've been getting from developers has been increasingly receptive. That people, and our developers are all over the map. You know, we have developers who are like crack on this stuff, or in certain areas, and then we have some who have blind spots. Mm-hmm. And even the ones who have blind spots have said, you know what, I know I have blind spots. You know, let me know what's going on. Help me understand what's the problem here, so that I can try to fix it in the future. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of good intent.
Yeah, definitely.
To learn more about that. Go ahead.
Personally, I've got a couple of specifically people who are activists and work in gaming for various racial minorities. Tanya DePass has an amazing awesome. Twitter and does her own live streams where you can just follow her playing video games and learn a lot just from her like commentary as she goes.
Can you throw out her Twitter handle so people can follow her?
Oh, she's at Cipher of Tear. So CYPHEROFTYR. Thank you.
What's another one? I Need Diverse Games?
Yes, that's the charity that... Charity/educational
organization
group that she runs.
Okay.
And they go to different video game companies and do like presentations about how to not be a racist asshole in your video games.
Jessica Price is kind of awesome too.
I follow Imani. I can never remember Imani Gandhi, I think. But she's a local Seattle activist.
I've learned to, I mean, I use the internet a lot. That sounds really stupid, right? But, flag. That's a thing I'm trying to fix myself on.
Yes.
There are a couple of words that I use all the time that I'm trying to be better about. Lame.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, let's talk about disability. Like, let's not call things lame to mean bad. Let's not call things crazy to mean bad. Let's not call things stupid to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds silly to say I use the internet.
Yeah. Plus, saying these things, or learning how to say what you actually mean, makes you a better writer.
Exactly.
It does. Because calling something crazy is easy. And quite frankly, it's kind of lazy. Yeah. You can find a better way to say what you mean. By sort of picking up on these words, then you can use the internet to say, okay, what are some other, you know, I'm trying to excise, this is one of my first big internet research areas in this, I got yelled at for calling something crazy. And I cried. I was like, I didn't understand why I was being yelled at. I didn't know what the problem was. And I was like, well, clearly I'm doing something wrong. So internet, hello, let's go. I have a couple of websites that I have bookmarked that are just words to use instead of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So absurd, ridiculous, ludicrous, outrageous. I love outrageous. I say it all the time.
Outrageous.
and then also talking about behavior instead of identity. And you can do that for any word that you find yourself using that you're saying, maybe I shouldn't be using this word. What can I say instead of lame? Right. Okay. That's one that we sort of picked up culturally. I don't remember the word for it right now. But what can we say instead? Let's look it up. You know, and the internet is, if you mm-hmm. you know, alternatives to X is a great place to start that search. You'll find people who've done who are really passionate about this stuff. You'll find organizations who sometimes talk mm-hmm. about it.
And I mean, my brain just completely broke on me. I've got nothing. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So I'm actually disability is one that I want to touch on a little bit. That's something that we're thinking about, mm-hmm. I guess. In as we were designing some of the stuff for the playtest, we had a lot of conversations about how we talk about deaf characters mm-hmm. and how we talk about blind characters. And so we actually ended up talking to some gamers who are deaf, who identify as deaf, and capital D deaf, about how do we write this in our game? Do we say capital D deaf to describe a deaf character? And we ultimately went with no. The reason being that capital D deaf in our society, and I didn't know this until I started looking at the national organization representing deaf and hard of hearing people in the United States, is that the capital D deaf is also associated with a cultural group. That there's a deep cultural identity of being deaf and communicating through sign and tactile means that is meaningful to people. And we felt very strange about appropriating that into a fantasy setting where there probably is an analog identity group, but we don't want to just take the real world one and drop it in whole cloth. Mm-hmm. Especially when in a rules text we're talking about what does it mean when you congenitally cannot hear and have adapted to that in the game setting. Mm-hmm. But so these are the kind of conversations we're having that we're trying, and, you know, and we're trying to learn. We're trying to go to the source. How do people who live this experience see it and engage with it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah.
All right, to touch on that here, right? In with what you're going forward with, you know, making sure certain terms or even disabilities are not necessarily mean that person is a bad guy. Because I know previously a lot of NPCs on Torchmaster, I think is what it is.
Grandmaster Torch.
Yeah, Grandmaster Torch, who was horribly scarred. He was generally considered not a nice character.
Mm-hmm.
And going away from that just because you have a physical disability, whether it's a club foot or horrible scars, doesn't necessarily mean you were.
Right, and there's a new venture captain who showed up, I think, in the last season, who is congenitally deaf, who has refused magical treatment for it because it's just part of who he is, and it's not a big deal. It's sort of off the cuff mentioned a couple of times as he's engaging with the party, and then you go on and he's a venture captain. And I wish I could tell you the scenario or his name. But I can't, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'm sure you considered this, probably that you'll talk about a little bit. You move madness into nightmares for domains. How did you consider people with PTSD in the center would also be there in the way
So I'm going to repeat that question because I think that's a question worth saying. When we changed from madness to nightmare, I'm going to rephrase your question a little bit. Did we consider the crossover with PTSD symptoms? And that is not something that was on my radar.
Yeah, me neither. But it's good to have it on our radar.
It's,
yeah,
now it's on our radar.
Yeah, you guys should talk to me.
So yeah, I mean, you have thought. Yeah, talk about it.
Out of nowhere, I have PTSD and chronic nightmares, but, I mean, it seems at first flush like the idea is, I mean, nightmares aren't a good thing, they don't help me sleep. It's describing, like, one of the unpleasant symptoms rather than the condition itself.
Mm-hmm. Just that, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on it.
Well, you know, to me it wasn't. Because, right, like having the symptom there doesn't necessarily make it a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bad thing, and in the game, it's a bad thing. And so, while I personally don't mind it to be an issue, I just wonder if other people might have talked about that before.
Yeah, I think that's something that we are, since it's been brought up, it's something we haven't necessarily thought about. Like, so definitely something we'll watch for. And it's actually one of the nice things about the playtest is that we will have an opportunity to sort of see some of this stuff. And if, you know, if we hear things, then yeah, then we have an opportunity to take those into account. Mm-hmm. Question over here.
Sociopaths, acceptable targets or not?
The overwhelming number of sociopaths in the real world aren't, you know, bloodthirsty killers or manipulative monsters, or they're just contributing members of society.
A lot of them are like heroes.
Oh, yeah. I heard surgeons are apparently, they have the highest percentage or something like that.
Because you stay steady.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know.
Fascinating. Yeah. That's a good question. I would be, if I saw the word sociopath in a turnover, in a text that was on my desk, I would flag it.
Yeah.
And I would look for ways to identify behavior instead of using that word.
You had a question back there.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing of trying to progress the understanding of mental illness, how do you justify that in, like, the Pathfinder, which is sort of like a straddling between medieval and Renaissance eras, where they don't even know germ theory. As soon as, like, the 70s heavily stigmatized mental illness, and we still don't understand.
I mean, the easiest way to justify that is it's a made-up world. Mm-hmm. We can have this world represent and reflect anything we want about the real world. I mean, plus, it's a world that's got 10,000 years of history since the last major, like, disaster plunged everything into the Dark Ages. So they could be as far, like, evolved beyond some of our modern day problems as we are beyond, you know, the problems we had during the Dark Ages in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just because it's a fantasy world doesn't mean we have to adopt all of the pieces of that setting. We're making it up. Let's make a world that models things we do want to see, rather than the things that unfortunately we don't have in our own world.
Yeah, it's not really intended to be historically accurate by any means. So we've got magic and
wizards,
dragons, and massive cities with sewer or pre-built sewer systems that are filled with monsters that eat all your sewage.
Could use some of those.
All right.
Your
hand was up first.
At its root, it's still a game, right?
Yeah, I'm repeat that for the stream, that nobody plays a game to feel personally alienated. I think that's a great thing to keep in mind as you're writing and designing games.
Yes, I've specifically stopped playing certain games because they make me feel personally alienated. Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
I'm going to let you call on people.
Okay.
you touched on, I think you call it stress in the horror book. Mm-hmm. I didn't find it, so. It reminded me of other forms of media that were going away from calling it insanity, a particular game that many people here probably heard of called The Darkest Dungeon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They call it stress.
Nice.
And the interesting thing how they handled it is once people got to a certain point, and there was a lot of factors causing stress, how dark it was, the creatures you faced, but they getting to a certain point where you basically go over the tipping point, they made it so that you can go to a bad side, like be masochistic or abusive or things like that. Or it tips you, when you hit that edge, you actually get to a point where you were more steadfast, courageous, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it kind of brings the idea of just because you're feeling this level of thing, when you reach that breaking point, you're not necessarily going to be, you know, go nuts. You could, you know, learn from it and break through.
Yeah, it is cool.
I think that's good. I think we get our industry as a whole has a real fascination with sort of the Lovecraftian sanity concept.
Yeah,
and
the Call of Cthulhu system.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of push to sort of explore other ways of dealing with these themes and storytelling elements, and I think that's really healthy for us.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Adrian.
Just with the question regarding, I guess, how you change madness to nightmare.
Like, because, I mean, I consider madness evil, but not that people who are have a mental illness are evil, but the fact that the mental illness itself is evil, like, it's separate from the person's identity. It's, like, you know, being crazy is a bad thing, but that doesn't make you a bad person. So I'm just wondering, like, was it necessary to shift it from, like, madness to nightmare? Because I think you have theories that, you know, that are evil with the madness domain and that are good with the madness domain. You know, the evil ones, obviously, they cause madness. They make you go crazy, where the good ones, you know, they help people with it. I just was wondering what your thoughts on that were.
Well, I personally just don't think mental illness is a bad thing. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we have a world that's built to accommodate the median, and mental illness doesn't make you, it's not a bad thing or a good thing, it's just a thing that pushes you to one side or the other of the median.
Mm-hmm.
There are some symptoms of mental illness that are bad because they just screw up your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
Like, I'd like to be able to sleep reliably.
Yeah.
But, I mean, most of the shit I'd have to deal with is, I mean, it's just kind of part of my life, and it's stuff that I understand, and when the world is okay accommodating it, it's not really that bad.
Exactly.
Right. I think there's another piece there that that I'm going to respectfully disagree with you on. And I think that the... I appreciate where you're coming from in saying that mental illness does not make someone bad and that the mental illness is the problem. But I think if we send a message that a mental illness is bad, then we're making a sort of complicated situation for someone who's saying, do I have a mental illness? To say, do I have this really bad thing? This is terrible. You know, and we sort of get, it sort of touches on physical disabilities. Is being deaf inherently bad? No, it's just how you are. It's just a condition. It would be very difficult for me as a hearing person to undergo that change, especially given my career as a musician. That would be rough. But if I were born deaf, or once if I lost my hearing, once I had adjusted to it, it would just be a part of who I was. And I think what we're trying to do is be sensitive to the fact that this is a difficult thing for people in the real world to deal with. But it is. And we can empower people to engage with it as it is, as a neutral element, more effectively if we're not saying, this is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do by this shift from madness into nightmare.
You in the back?
Sure. This is really something editors come up with. I'm gonna defer to Crystal on this one.
So the question is, are there certain stories you can't feel like you can't tell because it's hurtful to somebody? And I mean, it's a complicated question. If they're about an issue that I've dealt with personally, then I can tell a painful story about it with enough personal experience and nuance that it's genuine, and hopefully with the understanding that this one experience, this one story is separated enough from the broad category of, like, everybody who's had PTSD or everybody who's trans or everybody who's gay, then, you know, a writer who doesn't experience any of those things. But if it's a rough story deeply involving something that I have no personal, like, that I don't have the personal connection to understand the nuance of, then yeah, there's stories I don't necessarily need to be telling.
Mm-hmm. That actually seems like a pretty good way to put that. I don't know that there's necessarily anything that's off limits, but just what we are, what we have the experience to do well,
yeah,
and are comfortable doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a benefit of being a growing company, is that we are bringing in different voices, and we do have people who have different experiences that we can go to and get those perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In the green sleeves, had a chance to meet you.
What do you guys do when, like, you're writing a new adventure and you go back to look at older source material and there's stuff that's not cool? Like, one of the older soft covers from forever ago has this little blurb about a rascal and it makes him sound really misogynistic. And then in the newer stuff, that element's not there, but it's always been in the back of my brain, this deity is misogynistic. So how do you kind of bring that stuff forward with leaving the bad stuff behind, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Well, first we cringe when we see it. And then we think about what we can do about it in our newer products. And I mean, there's nothing we can do about the fact that it's been published already, but we can work very hard to just kind of eradicate that. Yeah, exactly. Like, forget we did that. But yeah, and just kind of make it better going forward.
Yeah. Or occasionally, you know, we can touch on that things change.
Yeah.
You know, deities are entities. They can and do change. And so that's something that we you know, if we feel strongly enough about, we could address. Mm-hmm. We have time for about one more question. Oh, there are two of you.
What do we do?
Paper, rock, scissors.
This one's really quick. Do you find that most of the writers that you work with respond well when you come to them saying, like, this is an issue, and how can we clarify what you mean?
We don't work with writers.
So I both work with and am a writer. Most writers are pretty decent people. They don't want to, like, step on anybody's toes. They don't want to make people feel bad. They want to try and tell the best possible story. Most of them are really open to criticism, especially when it's like, hey, you said this thing, and I don't think you meant it this way, but it's really insulting to people from Panama. And they're like, oh God, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize my grandmother came from Panama, and she never even talked about this. So usually people are really open to feedback. I think I've had two writers who've had, like, a temper tantrum about getting feedback along those lines. And,
yeah, actually,
I mean, if they don't want to change things that are problems, then I don't really have... I mean, I don't stop working with them all the time, but I know what I don't assign them from then on.
Yeah, and I think that's something that is maybe a good way to wrap this up, is that there's a lot of hate for social justice out on the internet. I was actually originally going to name this panel the Social Justice Warriors.
I'd be okay with that.
And I actually had to change it because we were worried it would be too controversial.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to go in with that sort of going up against that. But by and large, when you are talking to people, and one-on-one mm-hmm. or in small groups, and not just the faceless mass horde of the internet, people get this, and people want to do right, mm-hmm. and we just need to understand that we're people, and we're afraid of making mistakes, and, you know, we're all hiding behind our adult cutouts, but that we want to do well, and we want to do this right, and mm-hmm. so being compassionate and being thoughtful about it will go a really long way, and just don't... You know, don't be afraid to get out there and ask some questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of our job is just trying to give people a little bit of an escape from, you know, the pain they deal with day to day. And I mean, sometimes that's about, like, giving somebody who works as an accountant an excuse to, like, stab skeletons. And sometimes it's about, like, giving a gay kid an excuse to, like, be in a world where being gay isn't a bad thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm getting a wrap it up signal, so go ahead and wrap it up. I want to thank everybody for being here. This is tough stuff, and it's I'm glad to see a lot of people interested in it. So let's go out there and make some good games.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KD Con team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.